I am a story, you are a story, so is everyone. Those were the opening words from our Time for All Ages story this morning. I am, in fact, like you and like everyone, actually many stories, and here is one of mine. On the first day of social work school, which was an intensive program of 11 weeks in the summer, smashing in two semesters worth in that 11 weeks, then going out for 8 months of full-time internship. I did mine in Washington, D.C., in suburban Virginia, then back for 11 weeks of intensive work. There, on my first day of social work school, this is the mid-90s, I saw a fellow student, a white woman. She was wearing this remarkable necklace. It was a leather choker around her neck, and on it were small white conch shells. And it was the kind of jewelry that I had come to associate with friends of mine, black friends who were proud of their African-American heritage. And I still, to this day, remember my reaction. What is that white girl doing wearing that jewelry? Inside my mind, I began a story about her being a white girl wannabe who went around misappropriating black culture, and I already knew I did not like her. I have no problems with judgment, do I? As we began our classes, it turned out that she and I had all but one of our classes together, including our practice class, which involved a lot of reflection and deep getting to know one another. And as we introduced ourselves, she got to tell her story instead of my mind telling her story. She was biracial. Her mother was African American and her father was German, and she had grown up in Germany, which caught my attention because I too had spent time living in Germany. And in that split second, something happened in my brain that had absolutely nothing to do with my conscious mind. This woman, her name is Marijke, became in that moment black. Over time, and over many conversations, I acquired a more nuanced understanding of her racial identity and how she understood herself, and she has remained ever since much more in line with how she understands herself as a person of color and as biracial. And, of course, as the universe would have it, we became best friends for those 2.5 years of the most intense in our lives, to some degree, at least up to that point. Even now, I find it curious that at one time, I so clearly saw her as white as to have no shadow of a doubt. And then, as if there was a flick of a switch, I saw her as a person of color and cannot, for the life of me, see how I ever saw her as white. It's so clear to me that when it comes to race, my brain, the human brain, is operating in a way that my conscious mind has no control over. I know that you all did not miss the blogs and the tweets and the newspaper articles and the endless commentaries of the analysis of the voting, that when it's done, it's white people who voted this new reality into being. White men and white women. Undereducated. I won't use the word uneducated. You'll see it in the papers, but I find that condescending. And people who are formally educated, white people. Both. Though implicit bias is a human experience, it does not matter what your social location is, where your identity is, whether it reflects cultural privilege or cultural marginalization. As a faith community, as Unitarian Universalists that is predominantly white, sometimes overwhelmingly white, we must pay attention to how implicit bias, that unconscious brain click, can play out in dangerous, violent ways. Today's reading tells us that fear feeds on our acting negatively on implicit bias. And given that we have an incoming president and administration that uses as daily currency explicit hate and greases the tracks of society with fear and manipulation, it is important that we pay attention. That we pay attention to how implicit bias may be impacting us in ways we do not know. Our awareness and our acknowledgement is a first step to establishing a hard path through. Of course, we've all been schooled that stereotypes are bad, 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 and we are not to use them, or try not to use them, which typically results in our pretending that they have no sway over us, which leads us to underestimate how much sway they actually have in our lives. Many of us were taught that being colorblind was the right and honorable thing. We came to feel it in our bones as true when in fact it's mere habit, and a bad habit at that. We were taught seeing race or color is bad because it can lead to terrible things happening. This is true. Science backs this up. There are simulated experiments that have shown non-black people are more likely to shoot black suspects than other suspects. And certainly we see this backed up in news reports of black and brown men and women being shot disproportionately. So we know there is a terrible reality here. So what if it's not bad to see color and is, in fact, unavoidable? Unavoidable to see differences of all ilk, age, weight, ethnicity of varying sorts. What if it is unavoidable to not only see difference, but to attribute preference, typically one that falls along the lines of cultural oppression, preferring the younger person, more easily associating good with white and bad with black, holding a slight or moderate or significant preference for non-Arab or Muslim-sounding names? The science and theory behind implicit bias, what I've called the title of the sermon, Being in the Thrall of Fallen Angels, or if you look at the quote on your order of service, In the Thrall of Our Primitive Brain, is deeper and much more comprehensive than any notion of stereotype. While many out there theorize about implicit bias, it's really the research of Dr. Anthony Greenwald and his colleagues that is the go-to in this field. They have created scientifically driven tests, ones that over 5 million people have taken, and you too can take them. They're free on the internet, to be able to gauge one's own implicit bias on a long list of factors. This is, in fact, how I spent part of my study leave last week, taking implicit bias tests. 3 of them is where I focus. 1 based on age, which I thought I would ace since I'm married to somebody a whole generation older than myself and most of my friends are at least a decade older. Yeah, no. One on black and white, 1 on non-Arab versus Arab or Muslim-sounding names. And to be honest, there is no acing this test as if one answer is better than another. The answers are what you are given to work with. The will to take the test is, I think, in fact, what has the piece of acing it. The willingness to face what you might find there. The fallen angels within us all. As Australian Muslim community organizer Yasmin Abil Magid says, bias is not an accusation. You're biased. No, I'm human, I'm breathing. Rather, it is something that must be identified, acknowledged, and mitigated. I am telling you this because today's story by Julius Lester is good and true, and one that we like to all tell and it's very good for children. It's developmentally appropriate for many of the children in our RE program. But as youth and then older adults, we need to develop a more sophisticated understanding that holds the paradox of socially constructed race. Yes, we are all the same under our skin. And yes, we are different because of the social construction of race. And we all exist in a world where there are systems of oppression that benefit some and deprive others. If you are curious or confounded or have questions about this topic, I encourage you to mark your calendars and attend the 3-part film series showing here in January called Race: The Power of an Illusion. Each film is about an hour long, and there will be a facilitated conversation after each one. Thank you, Kathy and Reg, for being willing to do that. Though they are most powerful when watched all together and in community so that you can talk about what comes up, if you can't make all three, come to the ones you can. The creators of the implicit bias test suggest that currently there is not enough research to say for sure that implicit biases can be reduced, let alone eliminated. They actually recommend against most, not all, most packaged diversity trainings unless they are explicitly using evidence-based methods at reducing implicit bias. They encourage a focus on strategies that deny implicit bias a chance to operate, such as blind auditions or well-structured decision processes, like in hiring. I heard this story as I was doing my research, where they were talking about auditions. This was in the 1950s, auditions for an orchestra. And it was always men who were getting the key roles in the orchestra. And so they had a screen put up and had women and men both apply for the jobs and play. And still men were getting the jobs. Well, it turned out you could hear the click, click, click walking across the stage. And so they asked everyone to take off the shoes. And then, that is when women's hirings rose. So while they say that there are not currently enough research to say that implicit bias can be reduced, they are not the only word on the subject. There is emerging research, small studies that show promise, need replication to be sure, but that there are ways to influence implicit bias that dwells in us and in our primitive brains. And I want to raise here the Quaker sage Parker Palmer. He has some ideas about this kind of writ large, not so much for the individual, but for our culture. And in his book, Healing the Heart of Democracy, which is on the book club's list for May, so you might want to sign up for that. This was also a part of my study leave. He notes that learning how to hold life's tension in the responsive heart instead of in the reactive primitive brain is actually a key to cultural and democratic survival. He says, when the primitive brain takes charge, we are enthralled to the fallen angels and the outcome is altogether predictable. We contribute to the dynamic of violence that constantly threatens life itself. So there is some evidence that if you pair your acknowledgement that you have a bias while saturating yourself with real disconfirming examples that lean away from the bias, that you can reduce the bias or at least reduce your acting on it. So if your bias, like the media shows us, is violent men of color, if you saturate yourself with images, real life images of productive, creative, amazing people of color, you can reduce that. also by being in authentic relationship across divisions. This is part of why I spent my first half of seminary in a place where there was 30% student body who were Muslim. I had never been in relationship with Muslims before I went to seminary, and it has changed my whole understanding and capability of engaging in real relationships. But I want to tell you about meditation and how that is also a possible way, a path through. And it fits with Buddhism. The Buddha, he said there are four noble truths, but the three of them already existed. Right? Life is suffering. There is a cause to suffering, and it can cease. The Hindus already knew that. But when the Buddha came around, he said, there's a path out, and it's eightfold. That was revolutionary. And what science is finding, there's a study that says, in fact, mindfulness can bring us a chance. Using loving kindness meditation can dampen implicit bias. And then in 2014, there was this study that showed a control group and a study group. And the study group listened for 10 minutes, not to, you're bad, you have implicit bias, or love everyone, but pay attention to your body. Notice your body with non-judgment. Accept all that is there. That was the voice they listened to for 10 minutes. And then they took one of these implicit bias tests, and they found a marked, statistically relevant decrease in implicit bias, which means a decrease in acting on it. Now, there's no understanding that this is lasting. You get to listen for 10 minutes, and you're off the hook for the rest of your life. This is the thing about spiritual practice. It requires practice. So there's the path out, and then there's the hard path out. Practice is hard. Discipline is hard. But there is a way in which this may be possible. I will tell you another story about myself. And I am watching the shame rise in myself, but I have written it down here, so I'm going to tell it to you anyway. So any of you, when you're driving, lose your temper when you get cut off or your partner? Okay, so I'm not alone. So there are times when I curse out loud. I mean, you all have heard me curse, so I know that's not a surprise to most of you. But I'll curse out loud in the car. And that's fine. I have no problem. I believe swearing is a really good thing, actually. I taught my kids that way. But then there's this ugly thing that happens in my mind. I see the other driver, and these ugly thoughts come in there. Ones that I will not speak out loud. They are so, I won't even use the word embarrassing. I feel shame that they're there. They're racist. They're sexist. They're based on these cultural stories that my parents didn't teach me. But I still took them in. And my meditative practice has helped me to slow down. And this is what I've found. Get cut off. Parking place stolen out from under me. Reaction. Anger. Impatience. A split second. And then this layer of cultural vitriol. But my meditation, my practice has shown me that it doesn't come first. There's a pureness to my impatience, to my anger, and that this other thing is something separate. It's still there. But I learned it. And that means to me I can unlearn it. I can set it aside and not react to it and not react on it. That does not come from 10 minutes of an audio recording. That comes from practice. So I ask whatever universe might be listening, whatever humans might be listening, whatever gods might be listening, that we learn to quiet the noise of implicit bias so that we can truly hear the stories of each other and ourselves. May we find the courage and the perseverance to listen to the angels of our better natures. Amen. And blessed be.